We welcome back our good friend Tom Secker to the show. Tom is the co-author and co-researcher for the book National Security Cinema, along with Matt Alford, and the book uncovers the shocking new evidence of government control in Hollywood. Tom also runs the website spyculture.com, which is the world's leading research archive on government involvement in popular culture.
It's the Wide Shut Webcast.
Yeah, the subtitle, I guess, for the book is a little bit show-offy, but that was kind of the idea behind it. It's rather unabashed. It's a sort of advert for the book, the shocking new evidence of government control in Hollywood. So I think we got away with it, didn't we?
Well, you've got to do a bit of marketing for these things. If you just sort of put out a blank script of documents, then it probably wouldn't be as eye-catching.
No, sure. 17 people would read it. Yeah.
Now, the last time we did a show, we did a pretty good introduction to what these government agencies are doing in Hollywood and sort of how the process works in terms of trading sort of access for script changes. And broadly, the goal of that seems to be to sort of make sure the military or whomever, the CIA, the FBI, are presented in a positive light. And we talked about how filmmakers who don't really play ball with that system and don't act as propagandists, they lose the filming locations, they lose the access to the props and the hardware. And it can be difficult and quite expensive to make movies that they want to without that special relationship. And we touched on how there's a lot of schmoozing that goes on, people get tours of the CIA headquarters and all that kind of stuff. So we did kind of break down the premise of the book, and people should definitely go back and listen to that podcast if you haven't. But just to catch everybody up, and obviously the book's out now, it wasn't quite out when we last spoke. So just give us a quick overview of what you and Matt discovered and really the scope of all of this, because it's not just a couple of movies. This is multiple agencies, hundreds and hundreds of different productions. So just give us an overview of all this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the headlines are that it's over 800 movies have been influenced just by the Pentagon alone. And if you throw in FBI, CIA, all these other agencies, I'm sure that number goes to over 1,000. And also that something that was certainly never recognized at all before was their massive, massive role in television. I mean, if you look at just the titles, just the individual programs themselves, it's over 1,000. It's basically 1,000 since the turn of the century. Wow. So, and prior to the turn of the century, there's only, I think, a couple of hundred more. This is very much something that they've recently, as television has obviously expanded, you know, digital TV, online TV, and so on, as that was sort of massively expanding in the early 2000s, the Pentagon rewrote their approach to all of this. For the first few years, they never worked on reality TV. Then that all changed in, I think, 2004, 2005, and now they're working on everything from food truck face-off to, you know, Real Housewives of New Jersey, whatever. I'm not sure if they actually do work on that one, but you take my point that these days they're involved in the full spectrum of screen entertainment, not just movies, not just like military dramas and documentaries on TV, but everything from game shows, reality TV, sports broadcasts, the whole thing. So that was a bit of a shock, actually, to us when we were looking at these Entertainment Liaison Office reports, was just how many different types of entertainment the Pentagon support and influence.
Something that made me laugh. Why is Leon Panetta on Top Chef?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I mean, maybe he likes cooking, but like, what the hell?
I guess because the producers of Top Chef approached the CIA with this rather batty idea about, oh, we could have our contestants come in and like cook a meal for a bunch of CIA people. And there could be this sort of little game show element where they disguise the food as something else and you have to guess what it is. And that, I mean, that episode, I think, typifies Top Chef in general. I've watched a few of these since I was sort of did that episode on CIA and Top Chef. I've watched a few other episodes that had involvement from government agencies. And it's fairly typical of that. It is surprising, though, that they would let a really kind of low-rent, low-brow reality TV show come and film inside CIA headquarters. That's not something that a lot of productions have been granted. Even major films that have been supported weren't allowed to film at Langley, like the most recent Mission Impossible movie. But for some reason, they let Top Chef in. And yeah, you watch it, and there's Leon Panetta sat there talking about salads making bad jokes. I mean, it's a piece of PR, I guess, ultimately, but for Leon Panetta himself, who I think does have some kind of ego in this direction. I mean, this is a guy who, when the producers of Zero Dark Thirty were knocking around and, you know, they were sort of wandering around Langley talking to different people about how to make their film, Panetta was very much pushing the idea that him in the film, he would be portrayed as by Al Pacino. And he ended up with James Gandolfini, but, you know, he really was. He was, like, very keen on this whole Al Pacino thing. And you think, doesn't the CIA director have better things to do with his time? Really?
Well, that's kind of one of the more humorous examples. We didn't really get too deeply into the examples last time, but, you know, what are one or two examples of sort of big Hollywood movies, or maybe not so much big Hollywood movies, but just films where you can look at it and go, yeah, they've changed that script and it's changed the message of what that film would have actually have been. You know, not just this concept of, oh, well, we need to make this accurate. We need to show that, oh, the military, you know, they run in this formation. They don't do it like that. But what are some examples of where you've looked at this and gone, they're really trying to change the essence of this film?
One of the best examples, I think, is Contact, the 1997, I don't know, sci-fi epic of sorts. Because, I mean, the documentation we have on that film says that they civilianized a lot of the troublesome military content, like characters who were saying things they didn't want. Instead of having a military character say it, they changed it to the National Security Advisor. And one sequence that's in the script that was submitted to the Pentagon that isn't in the final film is where there's a helicopter approaching the construction site for this big alien wormhole machine thing that they're building. And in the original script, it's surrounded by the detritus of, I think they call it the detritus of 20th century war making, these sort of, you know, rotting, rusting military vehicles and all of that. And that's very, you know, powerful symbolic imagery saying, you know, we can leave behind the military industrial age and embrace a more peaceful age of discovery through, you know, space and science and so on. And that isn't in the final version. In that, when the similar sequence of a helicopter approaching the construction site is happening, there's no military hardware lying around rotting to pieces. It's a bunch of, like, a crowd of the public who are there waving signs of different kinds and all of that. So even in a film like that, which has, I would say, quite profound philosophical ideas for a Hollywood movie, they still compromised the underlying message of all of this and turned it into just a sort of affirmation of the virtues of scientific discovery rather than the notion of that replacing our current, you know, warmongering militaristic age. Another one. Hulk is an interesting one because even the Pentagon's own script notes on that one, they said, we appreciate we are asking for pretty radical changes here. And it's all sorts of things. Like, in the original script, basically, Bruce Banner's father is working at this military lab out in the desert, and he accidentally exposes himself to some kind of radiation beam, and then he passes on to his son, who is conceived and is born later, some kind of strange, you know, genetic abnormality as a result of this. And then 30 years later, Bruce Banner is working in the same lab. He's exposed to some different kind of radiation, and that turns him into the Hulk. there's other stuff in the film, like at one point Banner's father is ranting on about military experiments and poor young men who were used as guinea pigs for horrible, you know, military whatever's projects. That's removed. The lab is made into a civilian lab, a non-military lab. The guy who's running it is turned from a military character into an ex-military contractor. The whole thing was changed from a script which kind of, at least implicitly, blames the military for all of this, into a script where the military simply play the heroic role of tracking down and capturing Hulk. So, again, it's there are messages in these films that, whether they're even all that intentional or conscious by the writers, doesn't seem to matter that much. The military are just like, no, we're not having that in there. We're not giving you any support unless you change all of these things, so we're not to blame for anything.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because if, you know, if I was making a film and I thought, right, I'm going to make a profound statement about the military, and then the military says, no, you can't do that, you'd think they'd kick up more of a fuss. But I guess in some of these instances, they just say, oh, we'll do it about the military, and they don't really have a second thought about it. So when they say, no, make it a civilian group or a corporation or something, they don't really have any problems with that.
Well, for the most part, you know, they just want a bad guy or a you know, troublesome location or a mysterious place or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter whether it's military or not, for the most part. And those that do have those kind of politics, how much sway do they really have? They certainly don't have the sway of, you know, the Pentagon and its trillions of dollars in elite locations and props and people and unique knowledge and all the rest of the things that they can offer. So on the one hand, you have a scriptwriter saying, well, no, I think we should keep some of these elements in. And on the other hand, you have all that. What choice is the producer going to make?
Are there any examples of films that, I mean, obviously films have had scripts changed and there's been a relationship where that's happened. But what about sort of films that have been almost entirely in-house produced? Is there any examples of that where from the ground up, the DOD or any of these other organizations have actually worked to create a film entirely from scratch? Has that ever been a thing?
Act of Valor is pretty close to that. I mean, the whole thing actually stars real life Navy SEALs. They weren't just working as technical advisors, they're actually in the bloody film. So yeah, that's one where certainly the film not only wouldn't exist without the military support, but they not necessarily conceived of it, but I think they were floating the idea for a while, and then someone snapped and said, yeah, we'll make this. And then they said, oh, right, okay, right, we'd like it to have this, and this, and we're willing to offer you this, and this. And that was, you know, not entirely conceived by the Pentagon, but certainly, like you say, couldn't exist without them and was basically their project from the ground up. I'm trying to think of other ones. I mean, there's lots that certainly you couldn't make it without military support. The Transformers films spring to mind. True Lies. Could you make a film like that without the Marine Corps and the Navy and what have you? I don't think so. Top Gun. I mean, Top Gun, actually, I think they really did craft to a certain extent from the ground up as well. There's a lot of evidence in David Robb's book and in his articles and things on this that suggest they basically got the first draft of the script and kept going at it for months, saying, no, no, change this, no, add a bit more of this, no, change, take that out. I think they're also doing that for the second Top Gun movie, because that's out this year, next year maybe. They first approached the Pentagon about 5-6 years ago now, before they'd even written the first draft of the script. And from the Navy's liaison office reports, which are the most recent ones I've got, it very much suggests they were involved in what they call thematics, i.e. like the overall story and character arcs, not just bits and pieces of dialogue and little scenes here and there that they don't like. So yeah, that does seem to happen as well.
And something that I found quite interesting is how paranoid they seem to be sometimes, where they might change something that the average person probably wouldn't even notice, or even if they did, you know, is there any quantifiable way of knowing whether, you know, it even mattered? They seem to be quite paranoid sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's different ways of looking at this. Certainly in the internet age, where everything can instantly become a meme, you know, one little reference to something in a film can then turn into a thing that gets shared thousands and thousands of times, and millions of people see it and think about it and are provoked by it. So yeah, something like when in the Hulk, they changed the name of the mission to capture the Hulk, the military mission to capture him, from Operation Ranch Hand to Operation Angry Man. That's because Ranch Hand was this real-life Vietnam War operation that went on for several years, where they basically dumped millions of gallons of herbicides and other poisonous chemicals all over the Vietnamese countryside to try and starve them. So you think, well, would someone watching Hulk actually go and look up Ranch Hand on the internet and find this out? Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. But yeah, the Pentagon are that paranoid. They're like, oh, no, we can't have anything about our horrible past in Vietnam leaking its way into this comic book movie. I mean, stuff like in Rules of Engagement, there's a scene where Tommy Lee Jones's character is shown dancing cheek to cheek with a Marine Corps lieutenant. And they said, oh, no, we can't have that in there. Why not? This is at some party, like some award where he's getting a medal. You know, this is like the party that the guys back at the barracks are throwing in afterwards. Why can't he be shown dancing with, you know, a female Marine in a kind of entirely informal setting? It's not like he's doing this on the deck of a ship in the middle of a battle. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so they are. I'm struggling to think of other ones. I mean, there are tons of that in the book, and it's difficult to sort of remember every example. Was there any in particular you wanted me to pick up on? Or?
Well, I was curious, like, do they have a sort of a framework, a checklist of what they do accept and don't accept, or is it more sort of on the fly?
No, they don't have any such checklist. I mean, in interviewing Phil Strub, the chief DOD entertainment liaison, he said, essentially, we have an instruction, and the two criteria are, will this production help inform the public in an accurate way about what the military does? And the second one is, will it help recruit recruitment and retention programs, i.e. will it help get people into the military and keep them there?
Oh, wow. So there's an actual mandate there to they want it to help recruit people. That's interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at that and think, well, that could mean anything. I mean, so many different people will be influenced by so many different things that it does kind of give the Pentagon license to request any changes they like for any reason they like and say, oh, we think it might damage a retention program. Well, I mean, Strub himself, he said, you know, you can drive a train through a criteria like that. And it does mean he has quite a lot of freedom to object to all sorts of different aspects of scripts, whether it's about romantic relationships or war crimes or real history that they're trying to cover up or current political controversies or sexual harassment and assault in the military or you name it. You know, the list of different topics that they seem concerned with just goes on and on and on. And it goes way, way beyond any notion of technical accuracy and just sort of generally portraying the military well. It goes into political censorship and propaganda, and to a certain extent moral and social censorship and propaganda. So yeah, they're up to all sorts, and I think that's part of the reason they don't have a checklist, is because if they did have one, it would be as simple as they could send out the checklist to producers, they could go through their own script and say, right, we'll change this to this before we submit it to them. But instead, because they just have general criteria, it means the producers have to go to them. They go away, discuss it in a private room somewhere, and then come back and not even really give the reasons why they want these changes, but just demand them anyway.
And of course, I mean, you've got a big stack of movies that were altered in various ways, or at least you know there was a relationship between liaison officers and filmmakers and such. But of course, some movies don't even actually see the light of day. An interesting example in your book, this is the CIA. Tell us the story about how the CIA used a front company to blocker movie being made about Iran-Contra, because that seemed to go, you know, way beyond a couple of people in a PR office. This was some kind of covert operation.
Yeah, and not the first of its kind. But yeah, this was in the 1980s, at a time when the CIA basically didn't really have a presence in Hollywood. They started in the late 60s and early 70s, kind of formally supporting television film productions. But then when Bill Casey came in, he was sort of, no, we have to return to the days of the ultra-secret private CIA. So we're not going to let anyone into film, we're not going to support any TV, whatever. Then Frank Snepp, the former CIA agent who wrote a pretty explosive book about the CIA and got hammered by them for it, he was actually the first ex-CIA officer to get a script cleared by them in the mid-1980s. I don't know whether it was the script for this movie, but as he tells it, Marlon Brando was attached. It was a film, a pretty apparently hard-hitting film about Iran-Contra, and it seemed that this was going ahead. So the CIA, through a front company, effectively created a bidding war for the script, which they then won so that they could stop the film ever being made. They could just, you know, they had the rights over the script, so therefore they could ensure the film actually didn't happen. And this seems to be true. I mean, this rumor had been going around for a long time, and then Snepp confirmed it when Nicholas Shu asked him about it for his book on the CIA in Hollywood. As far as I know, this all actually happened. And you think, okay, that's the one we know about. I mean, there's a couple of other examples from the 1950s that are pretty similar, but we don't know how many times they could have done that since then. You know, since the 80s. So I can only assume they didn't just give up on that tactic.
So what are we to make of Tom Cruise and American Maid, which, you know, had that Iran-Contra element with Barry Seal and all that kind of thing? I actually watched that for the first time. Well, I say I watched it. I fell asleep halfway through, actually. But was that a state-sponsored movie, considering they obviously at one point didn't want any Iran-Contra stuff to get out there?
I don't know whether it was state-sponsored, but you have to look at Tom Cruise and Doug Liman. Both men have plenty of CIA contacts over the years. So my assumption is that it probably was. As to the, you know, whole sort of drug smuggling, weapon smuggling, Iran-Contra affair dimension, so much time has passed. You know, we are talking about 30 years ago now, that, and that many people know about it, the cat's out of the bag. So in some senses, there's a rationale there for supporting a film that does tell this story, but tells it in a kind of banal, trivial, oh, isn't this a kind of boy's own adventure with crazy Barry Seal? Rather than a, you know, this guy was a career CIA operative from way before it's portrayed in the film. They avoid all of his early career in Cuba and in the Caribbean, all of that. So I think it's one of those situations. And we've seen this in a few others. There is in the TV series Shooter, there is quite a lot of this sort of material. There's even a sequence where a guy is suicided, where they have this sort of thing that they strap on his head and they stick a gun in it, so it looks like he's held a gun to his head and blown his brains out. Very clever. And in the second season, there's all sorts of stuff about the CIA being involved in drug smuggling in Afghanistan, in the current, you know, war on terror in Afghanistan. And that series was CIA supported. So I think, as far as the drug smuggling goes, like I say, kind of too many people know about that now to just try and sort of cover it up again. So the other way is, let's manipulate the narrative. Let's make it look more like a kind of wacky adventure than a serious crime.
And while we're on the topic of the CIA, is it true that before the CIA even existed, its precursor was involved in a film that called for the creation of the CIA? Did I read that right?
Yep.
Wow.
that's OSS It's one of three films that actually the OSS supported in 1946, I think they all came out. And yeah, this there is a sequence in that film where some recruits into the OSS, some, you know, trainees, fresh-faced trainees, are being told by their senior instructor, the sort of figure of authority, we need a central intelligence agency. He uses those words. And this is before, excuse me, this is before the phrase central intelligence agency even appears in any government document. So they're promoting not just the idea of the CIA, but the very name before anyone was even really floating that officially. That has to be an attempt by the OSS to create, help create their post-war successor.
Well, it makes you wonder, like, they must have been, I guess, manipulating the image of the CIA from the beginning. It makes you wonder whether we we really know anything about the actual CIA, if as far back as that they were sort of thinking about the image of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, what do we really know about them? On one level, a huge amount in terms of like who worked for them and what kinds of operations they were involved in. But at the same time, we don't even know what the number one on the CIA's crown jewels list is. That document has never been properly unredacted for us to know. There are memos coming out via the CREST database that basically say, you've got senior CIA people saying there is a part of the CIA that the CIA itself doesn't know what it's doing. So,
wow.
We do have a problem with that sort of institution in that not only is there not a lot of external oversight, I don't think there's a huge amount of internal oversight. I actually genuinely believe half the time these units are kind of operating on their own steam. They're not really answering to anyone. So, as that applies to Hollywood, I mean, we tried our best in the book to write a really, really good, concise chapter on the history and present-day involvement of the CIA in Hollywood. I get the impression there's probably twice as much to know about that than we found out, and we were pretty satisfied by having kind of gone further than even very, very, you know, expert, great writers and authors on this subject. I think we went a bit further than they did. We incorporated a lot of new data. But even I think there's more out there. They've been doing more than this. This is just, again, this is the ones we know about.
So going on what we do know with the CIA and the DOD and all this that you've uncovered, sort of taking an overview of all of the productions they've been involved in, what is their message? What are they trying to accomplish? Is it as simple as just, we're the good guys, the US military, the CIA, we're the heroes, we never do anything shady, forget about that part of history. Is that essentially what they're trying to push, or are there other elements, other themes that you've sort of picked up on as well? I don't know. Is there anything that surprised you? Like they seem to be pushing robots or something. Is there anything interesting like that?
Certainly, the Pentagon are primarily interested in we're the good guys. We're a force for positive change or, you know, positive action in the world. That's partly because because the CIA are kind of latecomers to this party, whereas the DOD have been involved in Hollywood for a century. So they've been able to build up a Hollywood tradition, particularly in war movies, but essentially in any film that centrally characterizes and involves the military, where they're portrayed well, where they're, if not necessarily the main heroes, they're at least a supporting faction to the hero. So they have kind of an unrelentingly positive image throughout these films. The CIA, very different. And there's two ways of looking at this. Either it's because by the time they arrived in Hollywood in a proper sense, in the 1990s, there'd already been two or three decades of films about them, most of which portrayed them quite badly. So they had to kind of work with what was already there, they had to work with what they'd got. And as a result, a lot of CIA-supported films don't portray them as the heroes so much as a kind of necessary evil or a necessary force to protect us against a dark and dangerous world, even if that means they have to do horrible and illegal and immoral stuff. Or sometimes even the rational party in a crazy and unpredictable world. With the CIA, it's very much they'll support a film where it's not necessarily they are portrayed well so much as that they are necessary because the world is this horrible, complex, difficult place full of dangerous, threatening stuff. So, like I say, there's two ways of looking at that. It's either that they had to work with the rough clay that Hollywood had already provided them, but then we also found out that there's a reasonable argument to be made that they actually supported 3 days of the Condor, which is possibly the most anti-CIA, or at least perceived as the most anti-CIA, most critical of the CIA film ever made. So you have to wonder, even back in the 70s, did they have some inkling of maybe we can use the dark side of the CIA as a useful bit PR for us?
And well, do you think they perhaps like the I don't know, the bad boy image in some way, that maybe putting out a bit of fear about them, a bit of like, we're this powerful, stay away from us, don't get on our bad side or something? Do you think that's an element to this at all?
Yeah, I do, because I mean, when you go back to the early 50s with the whole Luigi Lirashi thing, this is when you had the head of censorship for Paramount, was essentially rewriting scripts for the CIA. He was, most of this wasn't about domestic propaganda, and certainly wasn't even about CIA's image, because they prevented anyone from putting them in films for the first 15 years of their existence. But Lirashi's, the main aim of the changes he was making was to portray America differently to a foreign audience, to make America seem a better place, basically, than the Soviet Union. So the notion of using cinema of propaganda aimed at the other, aimed at the enemy, or aimed at the public in a nation that you are in some way in conflict with, certainly occurred to them very early on. I mean, this was within 5 years of their existence, Lirashi was doing this. So the notion that 20 years later, they were thinking, actually, making us look like a bunch of ruthless, murderous sharks might actually be useful to us in some ways. I can totally believe that that line of thinking was going on. We just haven't found any documentation proving that. We can demonstrate that they seem to have supported films that portrayed them like that in the 1970s. We're not 100% sure of the reasoning why.
Well, as you say, yeah, Hollywood does have a global reach. I mean, the big blockbusters, you know, they end up in China and whatnot. So, yeah, I can see that they would perhaps at times sort of, you know, maybe the Western audience isn't the actual target audience. Yeah, that's quite interesting.
Well, you've got to think these days, even commercially, some people say that the Chinese market is actually bigger than the US domestic market. I don't know whether that's true yet. It's going to be true sooner or later. So I guess, and what I'm saying is that as Hollywood studios are looking to exploit foreign markets more and more, it only makes sense for government agencies to piggyback on that and try and use it for their own propaganda purposes, hopefully without the Chinese censors figuring out what they're doing, because otherwise they'll just remove that bit from the film. It's not a perfect system of propaganda. That's certainly true.
And how do you think these agencies... Well, I guess this is a broad question you could apply to the whole kind of military-industrial complex, but how do you think they view themselves? You know, do they think they're propagandists, or are they just on the right side of history? You mentioned towards the start there some public comments from Phil Strub, and Chase Brandon has spoken publicly a few times about this. But what sense do you get of their own perception of themselves, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. Strub seems to think that he's just doing something completely innocent and fair and just. he doesn't consider himself to be a propagandist, as far as I can tell, which is ludicrous, since he's probably the most powerful state propagandist in Hollywood in the last 30 years. But Chase Brandon? Very difficult to know what Chase Brandon thinks about anything, really, because he's so prone to contradicting himself. But I think he knows what he's up to. I mean, this is a guy who, within a year or so, taking over the position as the CIA's first entertainment liaison, was basically writing and pitching a script to Disney. He wasn't just sat there waiting for Hollywood producers to come to him so he could say, oh, well, I think it'd be more accurate if you change this guy to that or whatever. He was very proactively trying to influence Hollywood. So I'm pretty sure he knew he's a propagandist. And this is a guy who spent most of his CIA career knocking around Latin America doing covert operations. So he knows what this world is like. He knows what the CIA is. He knows, presumably he took the job as CIA Hollywood liaison because he knew what it would entail and he'd be good at it. So I can only assume this is a guy with a long history of psychological warfare operations and simply applied what he'd learned from all of that to Hollywood.
And what about Hollywood itself? I mean, they seem to have embraced these guys. But, I mean, you do get the odd sort of DVD extra where an actor sort of alludes to going to Langley and you know, checking out the hardware and seeing what people do and stuff. But has anyone in that bubble of Hollywood, you know, a director or a big actor or whatever, ever given sort of a deeper, more reflective account of this relationship with the DOD or another agency? How do you think Hollywood, I guess it's not going to be sort of the same for everybody. I mean, Hollywood's a big thing, but how do you think they view the relationship?
I think they view it as, this is how we get stuff that we want so we can make our movies kind of better or more fun or whatever. I get the impression most of them are pretty shallow about it. I've never known there be any kind of like Hollywood whistleblower on all of this. Like a filmmaker whose film got crushed by the DOD coming out and saying, this is what happened and this is why they killed my movie. That doesn't seem to happen. The only records of that relationship, and certainly those kind of, you know, sensorial, the part of that relationship, is within like these agencies themselves. And the CIA barely release anything, and the DOD are incredibly resistant, and I've had to be extremely stubborn to get even what we've got so far. So I think they just see it as, this is another thing we use to make our movies, and they're perfectly willing to make these compromises most of the time. There's not much indication of resistance from these producers to the demands of the Pentagon. I can only think of a handful of examples where it kind of went wrong and the producer just went ahead and did what they were going to do anyway. And yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, 2, 3, 4 maybe examples from the last 50 years. So for the most part, they just go along with it. They go along to get along because they want what's on offer.
But I thought Hollywood was this big liberal left-wing sort of club. They hate Trump, don't they? I mean, they're progressives, aren't they? Why are they so sort of ingrained in this pro-war, pro-security state system? Or, you know, is it just celebrities are full of shit and they're full of shit on this occasion as well? I mean, you look at Harvey Weinstein. I mean, if that's not a sign that they're kind of putting on one image to the public and behind the scenes, they're just hypocrites and, you know, just care about how they look outwardly to everybody else. It seems odd. I thought they were left wingers.
Well, I guess it depends whether you consider liberalism to be a left wing thing, in part. I mean, certainly I think most Hollywood liberals are somewhat liberal minded, but they're usually the sorts of liberals who, I don't know, set up their own private wind farm company or something like that. It's not really about addressing any serious societal problems because they're in that Hollywood bubble. And so an awful lot of this is just optics. right? You donate to charity, so you can go and do your PR event telling everyone that you donated a bunch of money to, you know, famine relief or whatever. It's not because you particularly care about those people. There may be a few that genuinely care, but most of them don't, quite clearly. So, you know, they're like palm trees. They just bend whichever way the wind is blowing. And if on this production that means suiting up and booting up and saluting that guy in the hat and saluting the flag and blowing up those brown people over there, then so be it. They don't seem to care, frankly. And quite a lot of them are actually actively on board with this. I mean, someone like Bruckheimer, Jerry Bruckheimer, he seems to live, Michael Bay as well, they just seem to live making pro-war, pro-US military movies. And so I don't know if anyone would ever consider Michael Bay a liberal. Certainly I don't think anyone would consider him left-wing. So, you know, Hollywood is a fairly broad church in that respect. There's a lot of lip service paid to liberalism, but like you say, Weinstein being a good example, clearly behind the scenes they know that the world is a lot uglier than they're pretending it is. So, yeah.
And it must be different for each agency, but from like a legal standpoint, what's the remit of the DOD or the CIA or the FBI? Are they, on paper, are they allowed to do what they're doing here? I mean, if we take the definition that this is a form of propaganda and it often is targeted at American people, that has to be some kind of breach. Aegon offices. Do they work inside a sort of legal framework? Do they have a code of how things are supposed to be done? Is this actually on paper anywhere? Can there be like a select committee that investigates their kind of operations, or is it just, you know?
Relatively recently, I guess, is that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, you remember they created this thing post 9/11, the Office of National Intelligence, because they supposedly needed a clearinghouse for all these different agencies to share information together. And obviously it works, you know, wonderfully well. They are conducting a review of this. The latest, I think it's the Intelligence Authorization Act, demanded that they conduct a review of all of the different agencies that they relate to. So DOD, Homeland Security, CIA, FBI, the whole lot. And essentially analyze and report back on their activities in the entertainment industry. But this seems to be in the sense of like whether they're getting value for money rather than whether what they're doing constitutes domestic propaganda, which it does. You know, of course it does. You make or help make 800 Hollywood movies, then every year you're helping to make several major movies that are being watched by millions, if not tens of millions, of people in your own country. If you're censoring parts of history that you don't want them to know about, that's definitely a form of domestic propaganda. And if that was the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany or wherever, we'd have no problem recognizing it as such. But because it's in the so-called, you know, secular, liberal, democratic West, it all gets a bit fudged, and everyone says, oh, well, aren't they just doing PR? I mean, is it really propaganda? Well, yes, it is. So whether that actually constitutes a legal issue, I mean, it has to, because the CIA is not allowed to do domestic propaganda in the US. There are laws passed to try and prevent them from doing that once they, you know, got caught doing it. So I assume those laws apply to all government agencies, or there are other laws applying to them, that should mean they're not allowed to do this. No one seems to be enforcing it, though. I mean, the only people who are, like, seriously investigating this are a bunch of random weirdos on the internet and a handful of academics.
I think it's quite interesting that since the last time we spoke, it's been a year or maybe more, this whole fake news thing has sort of become a thing, and it wasn't the last time we spoke. And people are now obsessed with the accuracy and the agendas behind the news, and governments, well, at least outwardly, appear to be paranoid about other governments pushing fake news and Russia bots and all that kind of stuff. There's lots of layers to that. But what people are forgetting, and what you and Matt have clearly highlighted, is that the manipulation of truth and sort of the shaping of culture, it's happening through entertainment. It's happening through movies and TV. You know, what do you say to people who say, well, it's just a movie, who cares? Is it just a movie?
I guess some movies are just movies, but there is a problem here in that the fundamental difference between the way people experience news and the way people experience entertainment is that news tends to make people feel bad. Entertainment tends to make people feel good. So the notion that the thing that's making you feel good is propagandizing you is harder to swallow than the notion that the thing that's making you feel bad is somehow propagandizing you. Thus, people are much more skeptical, even cynical, about news. Even the news that they pay for every day to read in the newspaper. They will sit there reading the newspaper saying, oh, half of this is a load of nonsense. You think, well, why are you paying for it and sat there reading it then? sorry, gripe. But like I say, the difference with entertainment is that people like entertainment. It's not just our escapism from the real world. It's actually just something that emotionally makes us happier, right? Otherwise, why would we bother with it? So people are more resistant psychologically and emotionally to the idea that they're being propagandized through the latest Marvel film than they are through the Washington Post or, you say, endofed.com. What I'd say to them is that you can enjoy a movie and also recognize its propagandistic elements. The other night I watched Black Hawk Down for the first time. I'd never actually seen it before. Or at least I'd only seen the bits that were relevant to part in the book that we were writing, if I'm being honest. But I actually sat down and watched the whole thing start to finish. I thought it was an excellent film. One of the best war films I've ever seen. One of Ridley Scott's best films. It's still a horrible piece of propaganda, but it's very well crafted and entertaining and tense and exciting. So a film can be both of these things at once, I guess is what I'm saying. And that there's no real contradiction or betrayal or problem in saying that it's both of these things at once. And that recognizing that some of your favorite films are also some of the most propagandistic ones. I mean, one of my favorite spy films from recent decades is The Recruit. And that's the one that I mentioned before that was basically originally scripted by Chase Brandon. The whole thing is an elaborate piece of CIA propaganda, but it's also a bloody good spy movie. So, yeah. They can be both at once, and there's no problem in recognizing them.
I think, like, it's obvious that films affect people. I mean, that goes without saying. But is there anything empirical? I mean, has there been studies to show that, oh, after viewing this film, people had this opinion, they changed their perceptions and things like that? Is there anything you can point to and go, look, this actually happens, rather than just kind of just the general notion that it does? I mean, I've gone back and watched films that I watched sort of as a kid, as a teenager, and I've been struck by, like, even just the soundtrack of the movie, and I've gone through, like, my iTunes and realised I've adopted the whole soundtrack of this movie without realising, and the emotions that brought with it, and I'm like, wow, this is stuck somewhere in my head. So it clearly has an effect, but what do we know in terms of the science behind propaganda? I guess there's a lot on that, but I mean, what's your take on that?
In terms of, like, trying to determine long term or on a mass scale, it's impossible, because how do you isolate films one factor among thousands of factors that affect people's emotions and thoughts about things and so on? So in that sense, I wouldn't even really try and point to any kind of data in terms of, like, mass public responses and the influence that it has on people like that. What I would suggest is that people go on the C-SPAN website and type in the names like Tom Clancy, James Bond, and just see how many times references to these books and films turn up in congressional inquiries and stuff like that. Or go through the records of the Supreme Court, who've cited 24 in their rulings. I mean, how many times did Ronald Reagan mention reading Tom Clancy books to everyone who would listen? I mean, this comes up time and time and time again. So it clearly has an influence on politicians, which I'd say in some ways is more important than its influence on the public. But in terms of being able to isolate short-term influences on people, there was a study, very good study, done where they showed audiences Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, two CIA-sponsored films, but two very different CIA-sponsored films. Argo is one of those rare ones which is just a really great positive piece of PR for the agency, where the CIA basically looked wonderful. Zero Dark Thirty shows them committing torture and assassination and all sorts. So, two very different portraits of the CIA, both supported by the agency. And they found, when they polled them before watching the films and after watching the films, that it wasn't just their perceptions of the agency depicted in the films that changed for the better. It was things like their perception of the entire direction of the country, or whether the government as a whole is doing a good job, were also affected very positively. And we're talking 20, 25, 30% of people whose opinions changed significantly. So, like I say, trying to isolate it over a long term on a mass scale, basically impossible sociologically. But if you extrapolate from that, hundreds of films and TV shows that people watch over decades, the kind of influence and presumably the scale of the sort of proportions of the population who can be influenced by this stuff, it's huge. It's got to be.
Who conducted that study? Like, what were they trying to find out? Was that...
Like, that's what they were trying to find out, was what is the short-term effect on people's political opinions of these Hollywood movies. That's what they set out to look at. It was an academic study. I can't remember off the top of my head the author's name, but she has actually written some other good stuff recently on sort of similar related thing.
Okay, so it wasn't like the CIA themselves trying to figure out the impact they were having.
No, sadly not. I've never come across anything quite like that. Although there was a special supplement to the CIA's in-house, like academic, magazine, where they went through a bunch of CIA-supported productions and asked CIA staff, employees, what they thought of them. And it is quite funny to read that, like, fresh recruits who were on their way to Camp Peary, the CIA's training facility, the one known as the Farm, they actually watched the recruit, which is about what they're about to go through, on the coach on the way there.
Right.
Who knew? And that's also kind of weird.
Yeah, that's kind of creepy, really.
Yeah. If you've seen the film, it certainly is, because one of the recruits ends up getting tortured.
Well, something else I wanted to get to you, Tom. I'm curious, what got you into all this? I mean, I guess you're a film fan.
Well, of course, yeah.
You recently did a subscriber podcast, actually, called Why I Do What I Do. And if people like Tom's work, definitely check out his Patreon and chip in a few dollars to get access to some of these exclusive podcasts. Because you do put out some really good stuff. But why do you do what you do?
I think this is the biggest unrecognized propaganda operation on Earth. Because, as we were saying before, people are pretty skeptical towards news these days, and the rise of the phrase fake news and, you know, that whole weird culture around that term has only contributed to that. You know, people are very much losing faith in news as a source of accurate information. And it's not that they necessarily think films are a source of accurate information. It's more that they end up absorbing this stuff anyway, whether they realize it, whether they're even conscious of it, thinking about it or not. They end up repeating things that they saw in movies when talking about the real world. So it's very, very effective. It's almost entirely unrecognized just how big it is and how politically influential and politically motivated it is. And that seems to me like a kind of missing piece of the puzzle. You know, how is it that they've managed to maintain such a strong warfare state, even though it seems most of the population don't believe the news propaganda? I think Hollywood is a big factor in that. It's a big factor in answering that question. So that's one element to it. Like you say, I'm a total film addict. I'm not going to deny that, ever. I love films. So understanding how and why they end up the way they do is personally very interesting to me. Politically, obviously, I'm quite anarchistic, so the notion of attacking the security state in some way, but in a peaceful and intellectual way, very much is part of my politics. I think that's, in some ways, the most important thing you can do politically these days is to try and apply pressure to the worst parts of government, because any government is something of a mixed bag, right, in terms of the consequences of its actions. I can't see very many positive results from the CIA and Pentagon's actions over the last however many decades they've existed. So they seem like a very, very worthwhile target to try and apply pressure to. So I do that in, like I say, peaceful ways, ways that use intelligence and creativity rather than just involve shooting people who are waiting in their cars to drive into Langley. And also, it's fun. I can't deny there is a real kind of entertaining element to finding imaginative ways to use the FOIA laws to get information out of these institutions that they really don't want to release. So the fact that they don't want to release it and the fact that they're so resistant tells me I'm onto something and that I'm doing something they don't want me to. So there's another reason, a sort of perverse sense of fun that I get out of it. I don't know. There's probably a dozen other reasons. You asked, how did I get into this? I don't know. Essentially, just I've always been obsessed with spy novels. This really started as trying to understand how spy novels and spy films relate to the real world of spying and whether real-life spies have a huge amount of influence on how they're portrayed in fiction. And out of that, obviously, came the more military side of things. So, yeah, that ultimately came from more of a personal interest in culture than anything political, I suppose.
Well, moving over to the research itself, because obviously you've
broken... Cool, look at this. You're talking about Seward, right? Lawrence Seward.
Yeah, yeah.
Who wrote several books in the early 2000s about American military involvement in Hollywood and essentially how the American military is portrayed in these films. And he has a whole bunch of stuff in an archive going back to the 1950s, some of it, and going all the way through to the late 1990s, which is annotated scripts, communications between producers and writers and the Pentagon, script notes, all sorts of stuff, right? All the stuff that we've now finally managed to prize some of it loose through Freedom of Information requests. But he just sort of, I think actually, as far as I understand it, the Pentagon was actually just going to throw all this out. They were just going to, dump it in the shredder and rescued this material. But the problem is he rescued it and stuck it in a private archive. So no one's been able to access that on any particular scale, at least since David Robb did for his book Operation Hollywood in 2004. Certainly no one on any scale before him and no one since then. And quite a number of people have tried. It does now seem most of that archive has actually been made publicly available. And so Matt is actually going there to go and try and mine it for useful information. And just to see what's in it, because it wasn't available before. Exactly how and why that's now become available, we don't know. So certainly for years, Seward maintained he couldn't provide other researchers with access to it until he'd finished writing and publishing on it, which you could argue is fair enough. I mean, anyone who has any research archive can say, I'm still working on this, and then I'll make it all public. Mm. You might argue this is a public institution, and these are actually publicly owned documents that were produced for public money, so therefore doesn't really have the right to do that. But, okay, there's a bit of a grey area there. But he hasn't published anything since 2005. And so for the following dozen years, he was just sat on all of this material. And that's not right. I don't think.
Your approach seems to be very open source. People can go right now to spyculture.com and pull up documents. Same with your other website, Investigating the Terror. You've got a lot of stuff out there that people can look through themselves. Even if you have an opinion, it's not like you're forcing it onto people. They can find the raw material themselves.
Yeah, sure. And that was partly why I did this, was because there hadn't been any great expose on this since David Robb wrote Operation Hollywood, and by the time I got into this, that was nearly a decade later. So I thought there should be an online archive. There should be a website where you can go and read authentic, original documents from these agencies about what they've been getting up to. And there wasn't one. So I thought, why not build it myself? I mean, it's like anything. You can kind of sit around complaining and saying, oh, the Pentagon's covering this up, or, you know, they won't let us know about that. Or you can take them on. You can say, no, I'm going to get this information out of them one way or another, and I'm going to publish it and make it freely available to everyone. So that's what I did. And continue to do. Yeah.
And what has the response been? Because to me, you know, this is a big deal. It's quite an exciting insight into how modern propaganda works. For a long time, I think, at least in sort of online circles, if you had these kinds of concerns about propaganda and things like that, you might sort of end up down the road of vigilante citizen and all that kind of Illuminati, MKUltra nonsense. And, you know, I always thought there must be something more tangible than, oh, I saw a triangle in a movie. There must be some kind of deeper analysis to all this kind of stuff. And you guys have legitimately found some pretty shocking documentation.
There was a fair amount of coverage of the book when it came out. Certainly as much as we could reasonably expect. Even actually could optimistically expect, to be honest. We were quite happy with the amount of coverage and recognition the book was getting, and has gotten. So they haven't really followed up, which bugs me, because there's a lot more to this that they could. It's like, you know, once that initial kind of burn of news stories was over, it was a bit difficult to try and get anyone to do anything more serious. But nonetheless, there's going to be an article in New York Magazine soon. There's supposed to be another one in an issue of Playboy. That's a real, you know, that's going on my CV. I've been in Playboy. But so that, you know, there are still other media organizations picking up on this story and following up, and some of them are asking very, very intelligent questions. I mean, I'm certainly not going to name any names, but, and I don't particularly want to slag off journalists who covered this subject, because I'm grateful to the fact that they have, but they do often ask some pretty dumb, simplistic questions that are obviously just about kind of knocking an article out. And I understand that's kind of the journalism industry, but it still bugs me. Some of them, though, have, like I say, asked very intelligent questions and are clearly trying to write a more expansive and relevant piece on this, actually trying to explain to people, this is how this works and this is the impact that it has. So I'm actually quite happy, I guess, with the mainstream media's response to this. I just wish there was more of it. And in particular, I would like it if one ambition we have for the second edition of the book is hopefully to try and get some kind of television documentary alongside it, so it can reach an audience that way. Because this information, okay, people like me and you read books, but let's face it, lots of people don't, whereas lots of people would watch a well-produced TV documentary about this. So that's kind of one ambition for, like I say, the second edition. The old media, well, they don't seem to care for the most part. And I haven't had that much old media interest in this, or certainly not what you would kind of describe as the big old media. I mean, there's been sort of, you know, podcasters here and there and radio shows here and there, and that's all great, but none of the big names seem to want to touch this. I don't know why. This should be right up their alley. And this is all based on government documents. It's not like anyone can really dispute this. But I guess because it doesn't necessarily fit into their preformed agendas about how propaganda works and who's doing what propaganda for what reasons, and certainly increasingly it doesn't fit into their political perspectives that seem to be quite uniform across the big alt-media figures. So they don't seem to want to touch it. Which, once again, it tells you something about them, about how sincere and genuine they are about the things that they say.
Mm. And what about sort of the academic community? Because, I mean, I guess Matt's kind of in that world. And you've definitely, obviously, this is academic work. You found the document. So is this kind of rubber stamped now in history? Have you been embraced by academics as such?
I certainly haven't, personally. but then I wouldn't be, would I? Because I'm not the academic of the pair of us who put all this together. We've published articles in major journals on this. There have been other articles like referencing our book and referencing this research. I do know of some academics who are using these documents, you know, in the classroom, teaching their students about this stuff. So, in terms of the information, it is breaking through, at least with those parts of academia that will actually touch this and do actually care about it. They're embracing it. And I guess to a certain extent they have embraced me personally, because I know quite a few of them personally. But I don't have any ambition in that direction. So it's not like, I mean, what would be the sign of me breaking through into that? Really, how would we even measure that? Because I'm never going to become an academic, so
right.
For all sorts of reasons, they wouldn't have me, and I wouldn't want to be there. So, yeah, they've done all right. I'm again fairly happy with the academic response to this. It's been as good as we could realistically hope it to be. It was never going to set the world on fire because, like I say, people have emotional reasons to just not want to hear this.
And what about sort of the movie fandom? Obviously, you said you're a big film fan. Is this a talking point within kind of the sphere of movie fans? Because I mean, for example, I'm a huge pro wrestling fan. If it came out that like Vince McMahon's writers were in cahoots with the DOD or something, I feel like that would be a huge topic within the sort of fan culture. So how has this sort of been received within sort of movie fandom?
I don't think they really want to talk about it too much. It's kind of it's an ugly side to a thing that's making them, that's ultimately kind of their, I don't know, hobby? I mean, the sorts of people who hang around on forums and chatter on endlessly about the latest Star Wars film, they're not the sorts of people who are going to want to hear this because it interrupts their enjoyment of the fantasy. It doesn't just interrupt it, it kind of smashes a wrecking ball into it. So, on the whole, so far I've not seen a lot of recognition from that part of the world. I think you're right, though. I think if people saw this and it was delivered from a source and in a way that didn't make it so hard for them to emotionally accept, rather than some, you know, nutty blogger like me, yeah, I think there probably would be quite a bit of controversy. And you did see things like recently, I'm going to be doing an episode of my podcast on this fairly soon, that the partnership between Marvel and Northrop Grumman, which had to be cancelled because there was such a backlash towards it. They were going to have like a special edition that they were going to circulate at the New York Comic Con, which was all about promoting the Avengers alongside Northrop Grumman employees. And people were like, you're promoting a defense contractor, you're promoting basically an arms dealer. And they didn't like that.
No.
The response to the Pentagon probably wouldn't be the same. People don't seem to have quite as much problem when it's a government agency compared to a private corporation making profits from this. But nonetheless, that gave me some sort of a bit of hope. You know, there is still some morality left in the entertainment culture. At least in the audience, it's consuming this stuff. But they do still have some lines that they think, no, we're not having you promote bleeding weapons dealers to us through comics. They refused and rejected that. So maybe one day we'll see a similar sort of thing happening with movies, but not yet.
And you mentioned just a bit ago about potential documentary. Am I right in thinking you yourself are also working on a documentary?
I don't know whether I'd call it a documentary so much as a kind of philosophical essay in video form.
Okay.
Because when I first showed the opening 5 minutes of this to a few people, the feedback I got was very much, this isn't really a documentary that you're making. It's much more confusing than that. So I am going to get into the Pentagon and the Science and Entertainment Exchange and their influence on particularly the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So it is about this stuff, but it's taking it from a more philosophical, less sort of political and sociological angle. It's quite different to what we did in the book, and it's not something I can ever imagine showing on TV. So, no, the hope is that some kind of, you know, news agency, maybe Russia Today, will actually pick up this story for the second edition and, like I say, make some kind of TV documentary to come out alongside it.
Yeah, well, maybe something, you know, in film form, maybe a bit more creative is what it might take to reach, you know, a whole different kind of audience. So I'll definitely look forward to seeing it.
No, sure. I mean, I thought about doing a pretty straight documentary, you know, the normal style documentary on this subject, but I wasn't sure what I would then do with it, and I didn't feel all that motivated, whereas this idea that I'm pursuing now is something that I wanted to do as a book, and then I wanted to do as a podcast series, and I finally settled on, no, just do it as a 90-minute film. It'll be lots of fun. And I haven't made a feature-length video of any kind for years, so it's nice to go back to that as well. This is more of a personal project. I don't really care whether this is successful or not. I'm more doing it because I've been working on this idea and thinking about this idea for over a year now, well over a year, and I needed to put it together in some form. So that's more the reason why I'm making the film than having any hope of this like busting through into the mainstream. Like I say, it's not going to be the sort of video that is ever going to get shown on TV, even on something like RT, they wouldn't show it. So it'll be something a bit different, I hope, to what I've done before.
Okay, well, before we let you go, obviously, as you say, your research is ongoing. This doesn't really ever end. So is there anything new that you've got that you want to share with people? Any new documents, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, the latest big haul was the Navy Entertainment Liaison Office reports. They cover about 800 pages covering 2012 to 2017, essentially what the Navy's Hollywood office has been up to. And there's information in there about script changes, about their curious relationship with NCIS, all sorts of stuff. And all of that will be going into the second edition of the book. But if you want a kind of preview of some of those things, you can have a look at those documents. I've got a bunch of stuff on the Department of Homeland Security that I'm hoping to find the time to publish on soon. There's a load of documents that the Army said that they're reviewing on this film, 12 Strong, that just came out. It was originally called Horse Soldiers. And that's a real life story based on a book that was written about the war in Afghanistan. So that's something I'm hoping to get some really good material on, because that sort of film really is important, or more important than an Iron Man film, you know what I'm saying? That films that are about real events and that give people an impression of real wars that are even ongoing, as the Afghanistan war is, I think they're more important. So I'm really hoping that when those documents come back, there'll be some very useful and revelatory material in them.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap things up there. Just remind people where they can go to check out your work, and also where they can get a copy of National Security Cinema.
The book's available on Amazon. If you type in National Security Cinema, I'm sure it'll come up. And, yeah, I mean, the one-stop shop for all of my work in this area is spyculture.com. You can listen to my podcast, Clandestine. You can have a look at the documents. You can read articles and reviews. And there's all sorts on there. So, yeah, spyculture.com.
Okay, awesome. That was Tom Secker. And of course, if you like this show, make sure to subscribe on YouTube, share the video, leave comments, all that good stuff. And I'll catch you all again next time.